Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Silvercrest Market Commentary conference call. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. Today's conference is being recorded. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero on your telephone. I would now like to introduce your speakers for today: Richard Hough, Chairman and CEO of Silvercrest; Robert Teeter, Head of Silvercrest Investment Policy and Strategy Group; and Jason Trenor, Chairman and CEO of Strategic. Please go ahead.
Thanks for joining us today. This is Rick Hough, CEO of Silvercrest, and really privileged to have a conversation with Jason Trenor, the founder and CEO of Strategus. Strategus is an advisory firm that was founded in 2006, about 14 years ago, a very close partner of Silvercrest in terms of looking at the macroeconomic picture, helping us refine strategy with regards to asset classes and thinking about other macro issues involved in the economy and the market. And we're really privileged as a firm to have a relationship with the professionals at Strategus and to have access to people like Jason. Jason, thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's my great pleasure, Rick. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So in this environment, you know, we've been talking about often with Rob Teeter, the head of our investment group, the fact that there's an enormous amount of quantitative data on the economy that we're used to getting from the normal channels, whether that's the Commerce Department or the Fed or somebody else. And all of that data has effectively become useless to us in thinking about the future and how to advise our clients. And so we've been relying on a lot of alternative measures of the economy, whether that's looking at hotel rooms or flights or gasoline usage, just for looking for signs of pickup in the economy, et cetera. And we've really learned to have to distrust a lot of that data and use our own intelligence and judgment and advisors like yourself to help us think through the history of financial markets, the history of economic slowdowns as unprecedented as the reasons for this one occurring, and tap into that expertise that we have and access with people like you to think about what the future may look like and what the recovery might look like. And so I'm just curious, as you think about the future, your own thoughts on active management and its role in an environment like this, and what you think its prospects are, and what the catalysts are or in the environment that could set the stage for active management to shine.
Right. Well, thanks. Thanks, Rick. And I agree with you, by the way. I tend to think financial markets are better economists than economists. You know, as a firm, I run a firm of economists that advises companies like yourself, institutional investors. And so there's always a certain humility, just having done this for 30 years, try to listen very carefully to the message the markets are telling us to make sure we don't miss anything. Because a lot of times the biggest mistakes are made, by the smartest people, let's say like long-term capital, when they ignore the messages of the markets and kind of chart their own path, tend to think that they're smarter than the collective wisdom that's in securities prices. Just having said that, as far as active management is concerned, to put it very simply, is that the reason why active management will reign supreme in the period that's coming up is that access to capital is going to be far more rationed than it has been over the last 11 years. And we could have a debate, I don't know, you know, there might be a variety of people that are familiar with some of these terms on the call or not, but we could have a debate about quantitative easing. In my opinion, Mae West once said, you know, too much of a good thing is terrific. But in my opinion, too much of quantitative easing did a lot of harm at a certain point because it obfuscated the message that you were getting from the prices from the market. And one of those, largely, is that you kept a lot of zombie companies, so-called zombie companies, in business, and you didn't allow the market to clear. And in an environment like that, I would use Sears as a, you know, kind of an object lesson in this, where in any normal period of time, any normal recovery, the cost of capital, cost of debt capital in particular, would rise, and weak companies would either go out of business or be restructured or bought by somebody else. And that largely wasn't allowed to happen from 2009 to 2020. And that's part of the reason, you know, earlier this year, and that's part of the reason why it's been so hard as an active manager. The dispersion between returns really wasn't as great as it had been in the past. Now, I think, to answer quickly, I think that's changed. I think interest rates are low, but bank lending standards are tightening, and I think that a lot of even the private markets have learned that there's a real price to liquidity that hadn't been priced in for a long period of time. And so now, again, I think it's a good period for active management, to the extent to which it's going to be much harder to access capital, and there'll be real benefits to being a winner or companies that have access to capital and can gain market share.
So you're talking about the pricing mechanisms in the markets, and to have the humility to understand what they're telling us. In this environment, a lot of people are skeptical of the run-up in the equity markets. Obviously, looking through this crisis and forecasting something of a recovery, how are you viewing that, and what are your views for economic activity and its resumption?
Yeah, so, and that's a great point. And I have to say, having said all that, I'm a little skeptical too. I'm not skeptical that there will be a recovery. What I am somewhat skeptical of is how long it may take. And one of the prices that I'll be looking at, or a market indicator I'll be looking at, that would give me more confidence in the rally in the stock market would be 10-year Treasury yields, which is to say, if 10-year Treasury yields were rising at the same time stocks had been going up since March 23rd, I'd feel a little bit more confident that we were going to come out of the this economic malaise very quickly. The fact that Treasury yields have stayed low, and just the length of time of the lockdown, leads me to be somewhat cautious, and that's largely because of the impact on the small business sector. There's about 150 million people in the workforce in the U.S. 25% of them, a little more than 25%, work for companies of less than 50 people. And it's that cohort, I would say, that at our firm worries us a bit. And this is an interesting period where large companies that are well capitalized are going to be able to take a lot of share, do quite well. You saw that with some of the retailers this week. But obviously a lot of smaller companies that don't have access, don't have permanent capital or don't have access to the capital markets, are going to find it hard, in my opinion, to survive, at least survive in the way that they had before. The payroll protection plan, you know, is largely designed to help small businesses. And I think it's imperfect, of course, but it's the right idea. The only problem I have with it, Rick, is that it's, you know, you're going to have to keep going back to the well. You're going to have to keep that going to prevent more layoffs. And I do think you're going to see a second wave of layoffs. I'm not too worried about a second wave of the virus, at least in terms of the way we're going to deal with it, which I don't think we're going to lock down the entire economy again. We did that. I am somewhat more worried about a second wave of layoffs, just as larger companies that are profitable start to come to grips with how things have changed. And just one quick example, I'll stop talking, would be the airline industry, as an example, believe it or not, has not laid anyone off. I happened to see the new CEO of United Airlines on CNBC yesterday, and one of the conditions for the aid from the federal government was not to lay anyone off until October 1st. And so that's a situation where clearly that business sadly will have to go through some pain, and there'll be some other large companies that have to go through some pain too. So long-winded way of saying, I think the market is realizing that the policies are pretty, I would say, very pro-growth, very different than the 30s, I would argue, that you will recover. I would just say I think it's going to take longer than a couple of months to kind of get back on our feet. And while this seems like an eternity, because a lot of us have been home and all the rest of it, it's only been 9 weeks. It's pretty remarkable turn of events for economy in simply 2 months. And so I would just urge people to be somewhat patient.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, Jason, this is Rob. Maybe just to tie together a couple of the things you were talking about there. We touched at the beginning a little bit on what's gone on in the market, particularly some of the comeback with the S&P, and as you talked about, some of the separation between winners and losers. One of the things that I know you've talked about some that I think folks would find quite interesting is some of the similarities and differences between the market, as people talk about it, you know, defined by the S&P, for example, and the economy defined by GDP. And there's some pretty significant and interesting differences and similarities there. I was wondering if you could maybe shed some light on that for the folks dialed in today.
Yeah, and we wrote a piece on this, you know, earlier in the week, and I'd be happy to, you know, share it with you guys if you wanted to pass it along. But the simple, and we have a list of things that are the differences, but the biggest difference, the simplest difference, is that GDP, a little less than 70% of it is made up of consumer spending. And the S&P 500 is much more intellectual property, capital spending, manufacturing oriented. And manufacturing, I put in kind of air quotes, because, you know, manufacturing could also be intellectual property. That doesn't have to be goods, hard goods. And so that's probably the biggest difference. So if you look at technology as an example, and I saw a technology analyst earlier today whom I respect quite a bit, saying that he thought the technology sector earnings in the S&P 500 would probably be flat this year. And the S&P 500 is 25% of the technology sector is 25% of the S&P 500. So when you think about that, you think about 30 million people, close to 30 million people are unemployed, and the technology sector will largely keep its earnings roughly the same as they were last year, is pretty remarkable. And so I guess the simple point is that the stocks that make up the index are more robust than individuals and to economic shocks. And so, again, that may be part of the reason why the market is doing well. It's really just a makeup of the index, which is made up of a lot of companies that people need, in some cases need more now with the crisis, whether it's technology or healthcare, than they might have before.
Yeah, so given that the virus is kind of driving the front end of this, and none of us on the call are medical experts as far as I'm aware, maybe take us through a little bit of your economic outlook over, you know, not only the next couple quarters, but the next few years as we move from where we are today through recovery, and kind of a range of outcomes that you see based on how the virus path unfolds, since we don't know exactly what will happen there.
Yeah. Well, listen, I think like you, I've tried to do everyone the favor, our clients the favor, of not weighing in too much on any sort of expectations on the health side, mainly because I don't know, and it seems increasingly apparent to me that a lot of the experts in the medical field don't know either. I mean, it's like watching a tennis match in terms of what people think about the nature of this virus and all the rest of it. But I would – so the, my own opinions are these, and, again, I don't want to offend anybody, but in my opinion, the real black swan for the economy wasn't necessarily the virus. It was the decision to lock down the entire economy. And I think historians, economic historians, are going to debate – whether, and we don't know, the jury is still very much out on that, whether it was the right thing to do at the time, I believe that, but economic historians will debate whether, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, that was the right thing to do or not, given the economic pain that it's inflicted, and social pain, too, I would argue, as well. So, you know, my opinion, and this, and here again, I'm going to put another disclaimer. I don't want to offend anyone's politics, but I do think that if we focus, I think, as we're largely trying to do, in growing our way out of the hole that's been created, it wouldn't surprise me if we got back to a run rate in earnings of we're back where we were in 2019 of about $160, $165 by the end of 2021, right? So, which would kind of make the prices, I think that's what the market is discounting right now, right, is that, you know, that as this will be a pretty big divot, but the economic policies that have largely been used to combat it are pretty free market, and I would say, I don't know if they're free market, but they're certainly pro-growth, put it that way, right? So we're not making the mistakes that we made, let's say, in the 30s, where at certain points we quite literally made every mistake in the book during the 30s. At one point, the Fed raised rates. We raised income taxes. We had an undistributed corporate profits tax. There was a trade war. We increased regulations dramatically. We did all those things at the same time. And that's what turned, you know, a pretty deep recession in 29, 30, 31 into the Depression, which lasted 12 years, 13 years, right? We're not doing those things now. But I will say that, so I think the path is quite good if we stay on this path and we just try to grow our way out. Again, not offending anyone's politics. The one thing that might worry me is if there was a Democratic sweep, one of the things that would worry me is that we do try a New Deal type approach to let's say, getting an equitable, so-called equitable or, you know, a fair recovery, as Bill de Blasio stated it. And we could debate whether that's good or not for the country or whatever. I just know from the stock market it would be a disaster. I feel quite strongly that that would be a problem because, like the 30s, capital would eventually go on strike. And that's when Ayn Rand in the 30s really started writing about all those things. So those are like the two. There's a range of outcomes. I'm leaning much more towards the first one as opposed to the second one, but I think the first one is the most likely case. The second one is kind of a risk case.
And Jason, on that point with regards to kind of the longer themes, a lot depends on whether or not our policymakers or the Fed make errors as we go along here, and that'll be a drawn out process. Obviously, debatable what an error looks like or what it is. But when you think about the longer term themes, or implications for how we've intervened in the economy. Let's just take one, which would have to do with this massive amount of stimulus to support those who have lost their jobs via, you know, unemployment and other direct income benefits, the access to capital given to certain industries, et cetera. What do you see as a risk in particular, perhaps from an inflation perspective, given the spike in money creation? What are your concerns around that? And what are, for example, could we be looking at a 1970s inflation and or stagflation scenario? Just put that on the table in that way.
Yeah, Rick, it's a great question, and I would say in the short term, you know, this is obviously pretty manifestly deflationary, just to the extent to which,
right,
obviously its impact on labor costs and real estate and all the rest of it. Having said that, I'm largely of the view that inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, and you know, it seems kind of quaint now, but the assets on the Fed's balance sheet before the financial crisis were $800 billion, and 90% of what was on the Fed's balance sheet was U.S. Treasury securities, mostly bills. So you wouldn't even have any, you know, duration risk. You know, again, now the Fed's balance sheet's $7 trillion. So let's just use round numbers. You know, it's an order of magnitude higher. And there's everything, you know, kind of short of, like, used dog toys, you know, on the balance sheet, right? So you're accepting a lot of stuff as collateral that might not, you know, might not really be, you know, kind of triple A, put it that way. So, you know, I think so the good news, I think that's actually appropriate for given the shock to the economy. I don't think it's inappropriate for the Fed to have done what it has done. I think if you pair that with the fiscal side, where the deficit before this happened was about $750 billion. That was the projection for this fiscal year. It looks like it's going to be more like $3.7 trillion this year, if not higher. The real question, I would say, Rick, is whether that becomes a permanent feature of our response to the crisis, which is to say that if we continue to layer debt upon debt, it seems to me there's a chance that, you know, you could get inflation in the intermediate meaning like 3 years out, intermediate to longer term, because as the economy improves, obviously the prices will correct, and then you're going to have you will have created an awful lot of liquidity sloshing around the economy where, and again, it gets very hard for politicians, easy for politicians and political actors to give things away, very hard for them to take them away. And inflation, I remember Milton Friedman saying inflation's a little bit like drinking. You know, it's like the first couple are easy and fun. And then, you know, once you start going down the bad stuff kind of comes later on. And that's, I think, one of the things that worries me, you know, a bit about doing what we're doing, is that it may be hard to rein this back in at a certain point. Remarkably, and this is also one last point, one of the things that I think the market is reflecting now is that remarkably, right now, our chief economist, Don Rismuller, thinks that personal income for the United States is only going to be down a couple of a percent this year because of all of the stimulus, the replacement of income that the government has provided, essentially providing a bridge loan to a lot of people that, you know, have been put out of work, sadly. So that's good. I mean, it's a good thing. Again, I'm of the view, I think you are too, that generally speaking, I'd rather have free markets and the price mechanism adjust to where capital is allocated than small groups of people, especially if the groups of people are unelected, like the FOMC.
Yeah, I would much rather see a normalized interest rate environment to allow for the appropriate allocation of capital, and also that allows for less discrimination among those who are the politically powerful to influence the flow of capital when you get to a normalized environment. But that's not the environment we're in, and you know, I have to slow myself down because I'm not an economist, and I'm going to get dangerous even pretending to be one. And I'm really talking about the longer term picture here with the amount of cash that's been created and that really the economy needs. I don't think anyone's disputing that it was necessary. And in the wake of the fact that it's not circulating and the turnover is very low, what you would call volatility, it's not much of a concern. And the backdrop, of course, has been one of declining prices, deflationary environment, whether that was leading into the crisis from the growth of technology and other productivity gains that have been hard to see but obviously exist, or due to the crisis itself, just because consumption's dropped in any number of categories. What tools do you see the Fed having to start pulling in that excess capital should it start things really pick up?
And I would argue, you know, Rick, it looks like, I'll just say, you know, for you and it may be the benefit of the audience, or at least just, and I'm wrong all the time, by the way. So, but my own opinion is that you're most likely to going to get further easing in the short term. It may not, I doubt that we'll actually see negative interest rates from the Fed. I know the president wants them, but I think he's thinking more like a commercial real estate developer than the leader of the free world. Because I think negative interest rates, frankly, do a lot more harm than good. My own opinion. I think the Fed tends to agree with that. There was a San Francisco Fed paper regarding that issue that was put out last year. I don't think that's likely. The size of balance sheet could get larger, and then these are the easing sides. The other thing would be what they call forward guidance, which is it's a fancy way of just saying the Fed would kind of guarantee that it would keep rates low for a certain period of time or until certain economic bogeys were met. And the thing that does is kind of more like jawboning, but it's nothing formal, but it gives the market, you know, much more transparency into when you'll see an interest rate increase. I think that's quite
I was just going to ask you to expand on that just a little bit and tying it into what we were talking about with inflation, because I know you've done some interesting work here as well. You know, one of the things we've observed is that, and I'm sure you have as well, is in the pre-virus environment, we got to a point where, you know, a 20 multiple on stocks was pretty normal and kind of pretty stable. I'm wondering what level of rates and what level of inflation you might look to as we normalize over the next few years. That's something that's a concern to that type of backdrop.
Yeah, well, and so the when we've done a histogram of PEs and inflation, and the simple answer, Rob, is that 4% inflation, which we're a mile away from, is below zero and above four are places where you see real degradation of PE multiples. The sweet spot is kind of where we are right now, 0 to 2. You tend to have the highest multiples on the market historically. 2 to 4, you see some decline, but not a lot. But over 4, you start to have a big lifestyle change in terms of PEs, and then below 0, at least in the data that we have, has been bad. There are periods, we'll get into this, there are good periods of deflation, like the latter part of the 19th century, which were all driven by productivity. And so deflation doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. It depends on the nature of it. In this case, the deflation we're getting is not necessarily because of productivity. We've had very low inflation, but we haven't had deflation. So long-winded answer, I'm very comfortable with an 18, 19, maybe even higher multiple on the market as a whole. And for some of those companies that actually are benefiting from this, it's not hard to see them attracting a multiple that would be higher. You know, if you're robust to a shock like this, if your business model is robust to a shock like this, it's worth a lot.
That's helpful guidepost to keep in mind.
Yeah, very helpful guidance. And as you think about kind of the longer term issues that I started to talk about, looking more medium term then, just to sum up it, kind of your thoughts on the market, given the interventions taking place, given interest rates, given what we're seeing with incomes, despite the great distress with regards to unemployment, just in terms of your own vision of getting through to the other side with regards to income by the end of the year, and even if the recovery is a bit slower than originally anticipated, since the lockdown, I think, lasted a bit longer than many people anticipated when this all first started in early March, end of February, the market, in your perspective, doesn't seem that out of line, that it's retraced and seems to be looking towards the end of 2021. Is that a fair summary?
I think it's very fair. And again, you know, some of that, as I said, I want to give myself an out to say, you know, a lot of that will depend on us not making things worse in terms of policies. But right. but I'm pretty confident, frankly, that we're unlikely, mainly because we had the 30s to learn from and we have other periods to learn from. And also, in many ways, a lot of the things the Fed has done and the Treasury Department have done were, you know, we benefited a lot in a strange way by the great financial crisis, the global financial crisis of 2008, 2009, because a lot of those facilities that the Fed created, for instance, were created first about 11 years ago. And that's a good thing. You know, they right. You know, so you didn't have to spend a lot of intellectual capital to figure out, all right, you know, these are the things we need to do to stabilize the economy. We don't want to punish good credits and all the rest of it. So I think, you know, I think the market's pretty fairly valued. You know, I think again, I don't know if I would put a lot more money to work here right now. I'd be kind of pretty selective. I do think it's going to be, because of some of the things I said before in terms of layoffs and all the rest of it, it is going to be more, you have to get ready for a lot more volatility, I believe, in the financial markets and the economy. It's going to be quite choppy, I believe. But that will provide opportunities for active managers, right, to buy good companies. And so, you know, I feel pretty good about, I'm a little more nervous about the economy than I am about the markets. It may sound strange, but that's for all the reasons I said before. I think the markets, just given the structure, are in decent shape and are reflecting the enormous amount of stimulus, monetary and fiscal stimulus that's been provided.
Uh-huh. Right. Right. Rob, how does that fit with our own outlook and how we're working with client portfolios?
Yeah, I think it's pretty similar. You know, we share a lot of your views, Jason, and think that this is a time particularly to be very selective with regard to what you do, to have the right time horizon. If ever there was a time to not try to, you know, predict what's going on day to day, I think it might be now, and I think that helps a lot. And we share a lot of your long-term backdrop as well in terms of economic outlook and valuation on stocks. We've sort of turned things upside down again with that 20 multiple that had hung in there for a long time pre-virus and backed into it and said, you know, what level of earnings does that imply for the markets here? And does that seem reasonable? And I think we agree with you. It seems, you know, mostly reasonable, recognizing there's a lot of divergence beneath the surface and a lot of potential paths going forward.
And of course,
you know, maybe shifting. Go ahead, Rick.
No, I was just going to say, and of course, that divergence between companies, those that are winning or losing in the immediate term, provides a lot of opportunity to reorient portfolios and be rely on really good bottom-up fundamental analysis to get through it.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's very much a key here. Maybe shifting gears just a little bit, Jason, to get your thoughts on another topic that that we've been asked a lot by clients, and I'm sure you have as well. Any bigger picture changes in terms of, you know, whether it's onshoring of U.S. manufacturing, whether it's in tech or pharmaceuticals, or changes in how supply chains are managed or things like that as a result of the virus?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Rob, we wrote a couple of essays in April just on the long-term winners and losers, we thought, from COVID, because it is obviously a very meaningful historical event now. I'll be quite candid. I didn't quite appreciate that in early March. By the end of March, I appreciated it in a big way. And there are certain things, in my opinion, that will not go back to the way they were. And I think one of them is the relationship between the U.S. and China. And that may be true, frankly, for a lot of countries and China. And I think, you know, as an example, I think the trade war last year, you want to call it a trade war, but certainly trade tensions between the U.S. and China, if that didn't get you to reconsider diversifying your supply chains, this has to. And you can see that if you look at a lot of the polling of Americans now, it's very clear that majority of people, both Republicans and Democrats, by the way, it's pretty bipartisan, you know, tend to view China as a rival, you know, as opposed to an economic partner. Whereas, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, it was generally seen as this kind of symbiotic relationship. They had a different different political system and culture than we did, and you know, it's two different paths. It's, you know, it's fine. We're not going to judge people on it and so on. I think now that's changed quite a bit, and so pharmaceuticals, I think, I haven't seen the data to back this up. I keep hearing the number, so I don't quote me on this, but I've heard that 85% of our antibiotics have at least some part of their supply chain through China. And I would argue that just will not be the case a year from now, regardless of who's president. And I think this is one of the few places where Republicans and Democrats are pretty aligned on this issue. I think there's other industries too, certainly because of the amount of unemployment that we have, there's going to be an interest in bringing some industries back, either for national security reasons, you know, something like steel, or just because we lost a lot of jobs. And if you look over the last 25 years, we lost most of the jobs in terms of manufacturing, not all of them, but a good portion of them were in things like textiles and furniture. And so there are going to be a combination, I would say, of goods that are seen as national security priorities, and there are going to be other goods where people might say, listen, we're just going to pay a little more because it's good for us, and we're okay with that. And so I think that's a big change. I mean, there's other stuff like high-priced college education. I think globalization, generally speaking, I think is changing quite a bit, people's attitudes towards that. So those are some of the big – and commercial real estate would be another one. I'll stop there. But that's another one where I do think there's going to be a meaningful change in the way we look at that.
Yeah, there's certainly no shortage of themes that were in place before and are being accelerated by all of this, and new themes that are taking hold as a result. We know you're out there a lot talking to folks like us and talking to all types of different investors and companies and everything else. Can you maybe give us some insight into what you're hearing about the most from the folks you're talking to? What's front of mind? What are big issues for people these days?
Yeah, I would say the questions that we're getting most from clients, I would say one is, you know, what is the question, rather, that you asked before is, you know, what's the difference between the market and the economy? You know, why is the economy look like it's on the verge of another depression, and why is market up? And so that we get that question a lot. It's a very natural question, but, we gave the answer to that. I think one of the questions we're asking our clients, because we're always trying to get some sense of where the consensus lies, and one of the questions we're asking our clients is where they think the next 10% in the S&P 500 is going to be. And 80%, the last two surveys we did last week and 2 weeks prior to that, in each case, 80% of the people that we surveyed, institutional investors, thought the next 10% was lower. And so that may be part of the reason why the market's not going lower, is because there's still a fair amount of skepticism in the move, right? So that's kind of a good thing if you're bullish, right, that it's not like people are just completely throwing caution to the wind and just buying. The other question we get asked a lot is, and it's a derivative of Rick's question before, in terms of all of the fiscal stimulus, the question we get a lot is it inevitable that the federal government's going to have to raise taxes to pay for this? And the simple answer, I would say, is that it depends on who wins in November. I know some of the members of the president's economic team, and you may think this is crazy, or not crazy, but or what have you. But I can tell you for a fact that they are thinking more about tax cuts right now than tax increases. And so, you know, it's they're this administration's very comfortable with debt. You know, I think given the guy at the top, of course, real estate guy, obviously, debt is not a four-letter word to him. You know, and I think the administration's view is largely that the markets will tell you when it's a problem. And the dollar being as strong as it is and 10-year treasury yields kind of staying where they are, you know, their view is the best way to deal with this is to grow your way out. So that's another question I would say we get quite a bit. And, you know, it depends. If it's another, you know, if there's a Democratic sweep, I do think you'd have to start thinking about the possibility of a wealth tax or value-added tax or something along those lines. I hope that's not the case, but I would suspect that you'd hear a lot more discussion of that.
Yeah, there's certainly going to be a lot of noise in a presidential election year. That's for certain. Whether it relates to just like you're talking about tax policy, or if the regulatory issues come to the forefront again around technology, or in other instances if we are re-onshoring and whether those issues come to the fore as well. Definitely no shortage of big issues to talk about on this call and in general. I thought what we'd do now, unless Rick has another question, he may have had a problem with his line there.
Yeah, I just have one follow-up question, and then I think we'll take some questions from people listening in on the call. Jason, I didn't really prepare you for this, but the United States has been such an attractive place for capital. Its equity markets are performing well versus a lot of the world, and has been growing at a more sustainable pace than many other places in the world. And some of that has to do with the dollar. Some of it has to do with the maturity of our capital systems and flexible economy, diversified economy. But you and your research have noted that over the past 15, 20 years, a substantial amount of the inflows into the U.S. markets, the equity markets in particular, have been from foreign entities. And an important piece of the increasing equity markets. Are you continuing to see those flows? Is my thesis correct, or my recollection correct? And do you see that changing over the next couple of years?
So, Rick, your recollection is crystal clear, and I think it's been reinforced. I mean, another kind of a very specific answer. People say, "What, you know, why is the market up so much, despite how weak the economy is getting?" Part of it is just the flows from international investors to places they believe are most safe, right? So the dollar being the reserve currency is attracting a lot of it has attracted a lot of foreign capital over the last, you know, 10 years. It's attracting more now. I do think that there's also pension plans that probably were underweight public equities. That's one of the reasons that you're seeing the market go up. But I think, you know, again, as going back to your point, I think the dollar, it's hard to think of anything that would compete with the dollar as a reserve currency. The only thing that seems to be out there would be gold. I would argue, you know, the dollar is strengthening versus virtually every other fiat currency. The only currency, if you want to call it that it's depreciating against is gold. And all fiat currencies are appreciating against gold. I think people are doing that largely as a hedge to the things that we just discussed before, which is
right.
As a hedge if this becomes permanent. People
right.
hope it's not permanent, but they kind of view it as insurance. And just like insurance, you know, you kind of hope you never have to make a claim. But I think people are saying, like, all right, you know, just in case, I'm going to buy some of this. I think one other thing, Rick, I would just say is that another big source of demand for equities over the past 10 years have been corporations themselves.
Right.
You know, share buybacks have been enormous.
Yeah.
And so I would say that's going to be something that'll be on the other side. That offsets some of the foreign flows a little bit just because certain companies obviously are going to have other priorities like paying down debt and so on. I don't think there's any chance of share buybacks becoming illegal or anything like that, but there are certain companies obviously that are going to have other priorities.
And sentiment affects these things, and undoubtedly public CEOs are sensitive to the perceptions of their use of capital in this kind of environment. Before we get to questions, I did get one here via email while we were talking, and we didn't talk about the energy sector. We talked pharma a little bit, but it's a mess, right? We've seen unbelievably low oil prices, very, very low demand as a consequence of the shutdown. Of course, there's the investment headwind of ESG, environment, right, social and governance investing.
Right.
And then, you know, of course, the COVID emergency here. So what do you all see as the prospects for the U.S. energy sector? Is it headed to a lot more trouble and a kind of a long, slow decline, or do you view this as a bump in the road as a consequence of just a crash of demand?
It's probably somewhere, Rick, in between. I mean, I in my opinion, there's too much capacity in the energy sector that has to be, and it's maybe one of the negative consequences of keeping rates so low, is that you did keep a lot of, you know, we talked about this whole idea of zombie companies a bit. A lot of the zombie companies were energy companies where you know, very low interest rates allowed a lot of companies to punch holes in the ground. In that regard, you know, this could wind up being a positive in an odd way, because it's such a big shock that you'll take some excess capacity out of the market, which could make people more confident about the price of oil in the future. Right. So I would, you know, kind of look to see more consolidation and M&A in that area. If I saw that, I would actually get bullish. I also think this may be not popular, but I think that, you know, at the margin, lower energy prices make alternative energy somewhat more costly in comparison. So I think I'm not saying that's going to disappear, that headwind against energy, but I think this slows it down a bit. You know, it's interesting. I saw my first kind of divest from China letter that, you know, just in the ether. I think it was sent to Larry Fink. And so, you know, there's, you know, that kind of aligning of mission and investing, you know, it's clearly, you know, it's getting into a lot of places more than just issues of sustainability and renewable energy.
Thanks for that. Let's open the lines and take some questions if we have anyone listening in on the call would like to ask you something.
Thank
you. Operator,
if
you could do that. Thanks.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one. One moment, please.
Thank you. We'll just give that a second to see who queues up.
I'm showing no questions at this time.
Okay, thank you very much. Jason, it's been instructive. I really appreciate the time you spent with Rob Teeter and myself today to talk about all this. You're a great partner, and we appreciate you doing this.
Well, it's my great pleasure, Rick and Rob, and you guys, you know, you're great fiduciaries and great partners. So I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your clients, and be happy to answer any other questions people might have. But thank you very much.
You're welcome, and we'll talk to you soon. And hopefully, we get you in the flesh in a live format with folks.
Yeah, Yes, sir. Okay.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Thanks, Jason.
Bye.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect. Have a great day.